and the reception that followed oozed politics. They held the reception at the University of Minnesota's Humphrey Institute. Guests wandered through the permanent exhibit chronicling the life of one of Minnesota's most beloved Democratic leaders, recalled the Star Tribune. Klobuchar clearly had the political bug. In the fall of 1993, she made plans to run for chief prosecutor of Hennepin County, the largest and most significant prosecutorial job in Minnesota. Hennepin County incorporates much of Minneapolis. However, she ended up deferring to a more established candidate, the incumbent Mike Freeman, just 5 months before the 1994 election. By 1998, she was ready to throw her hat in the ring again. Even though her legal experience at this point revolved largely around telecom companies, she went on to win a tight victory by less than 1% of the vote. As chief prosecutor, she was in charge of more than 150 lawyers. Klobuchar paints a portrait of her tenure as one involving hand-to-hand combat with white-collar criminals. It is a central component of her message as a progressive. "We really pushed the envelope in one other area, white-collar crime," she wrote in her autobiography. She describes how her office was taking many white-collar criminal referrals, from investment swindles and contractor fraud to tax evasion and identity theft rings. According to her version of events, she triumphed and operated without fear or favor. As we will see, that depends on what sort of white-collar criminal you were and what sort of political connections you might enjoy. Indeed, she seemed in her prosecutorial record to punch down by throwing the book at smaller fish while avoiding prosecutions of larger and more serious criminal operators. Klobuchar aggressively went after small actors accused of financial crimes and fraud. There was the home remodeler in Burnsville, Minnesota, who pleaded guilty to 8 felony counts for swindling homeowners out of $1 million, netting 75% of that. Klobuchar threw the book at him. He got 2 years in prison. She also took on airline pilots who worked for Minneapolis-based Northwest Airlines. According to Klobuchar and her office, 42 Northwest Airlines pilots were investigated for not paying Minnesota income taxes by claiming residence in other states, even though they spent much of their time in the state. They collectively owed some $321,000 in state taxes. Klobuchar charged 7 pilots with tax evasion. The pilots argued that they lived in other states and would arrive in Minneapolis for their flight assignments. Klobuchar declared the airline pilots were white-collar crooks in her book, further proof that she was tough on white-collar crime. But the largest financial fraud by far in her jurisdiction involved a massive conspiracy that she never even appeared to investigate, despite plenty of warning signs. It involved the second largest Ponzi scheme in American history to date, surpassed only by Bernie Madoff. It involved billions of dollars, dummy corporations, and an elaborate scheme that ripped off investors for hundreds of millions of dollars. The man at the center of it, however, happened to be in business with the Mondales, was a Klobuchar friend, and one of her largest financial backers. Indeed, Petters Group International, or PGI, would prove to be her single largest campaign donor when she ran for the Senate in 2006. Despite plenty of warning signs, she appears to have looked the other way. Tom Petters purported to be a billionaire and a philanthropist. His firm, Petters Group Worldwide, or its subsidiaries, employed family members of Minnesota's political elite. Bill Mondale, son of the former vice president, worked for Petters as the director of international business development of Petters Consumer Brands, LLC. Ted Mondale, the former vice president's eldest son and a former state senator, was vice president of a Petters company from 1999 to 2003. When Ted left to launch a software company, he received a $750,000 investment from Petters. Petters also gave him a $150,000 personal loan. Later, when federal officials charged Petters for his crimes, he admitted that he used the Mondale name to solidify his company's reputation. When he was trying to drum up business in Asia, for example, he would drop Walter Mondale's name because Mondale had served as ambassador to Japan. His ties to the Mondales opened up incredible doors. It was his relationship with Klobuchar and her office that might have been even more important, because they probably delayed his legal day of reckoning. When Klobuchar ran for county attorney in 1998, Petters and his employees gave her campaign $8,500. That was just the start. When she announced for the U.S. Senate in 2006, Petters Group Worldwide and its employees were some of her earliest and most enthusiastic donors. Just weeks after she announced her candidacy in February 2005, Petters and 13 employees in his companies gave her contributions in a single day, March 31, 2005. By the quarterly report released right before the 2006 election, they were her largest contributor by far, donating $71,600, or 32% more than her second largest donor, her old law firm. By the end of 2006, Petter's group worldwide had contributed more than $120,000 toward her successful bid. One of the reasons Petter's may have been able to operate is that the Hennepin County Attorney's Office reportedly had worked to expunge his records of a previous arrest on fraud charges. While living in Colorado, Petter's was accused of forgery and fraud, the alleged crime involving some $75,000 worth of VCRs that apparently did not even really exist. Petter's moved to Minnesota and made a financial restitution payment to avoid a fugitive warrant, but the arrest was still on his record. Obviously, it would be more difficult to launch a financial firm with this lurking on his record. He went to the Hennepin County Attorney's Office and, with the reported help of an assistant county attorney named Nancy McLean, got his record wiped clean. This happened under Michael Freeman, Klobuchar's predecessor. When Klobuchar replaced him in 1998, McLean stayed on as an assistant county attorney. During Klobuchar's tenure as county attorney, there appear to have been early warning signs of what Petter's was doing. In January 1999, just weeks into her tenure, potential evidence of the Ponzi scheme began to cross her desk. Officers from her office raided the home of Richard Hettler and Ruth Kahn. They were Petter's investors. The documents seized reportedly offered clear evidence that Hettler, Kahn, and Petter's were engaged in a mutually beneficial and highly illegal financial scheme. Klobuchar threw the book at Hettler and Kahn, charging them with fraud, but she did not prosecute or apparently even investigate Petter's. The Hennepin County Attorney's Office would issue a statement in 2012 defending Klobuchar's inaction regarding Petter's. At no time was the Hennepin County Attorney's Office presented by any law enforcement agency a case against Tom Petter's. There were plenty of other warning signs as to what Petter's was doing. There were numerous lawsuits against Petter's for failing to repay money he owed. There were criminal cases for allegedly writing bad checks. Some clients who had invested money with Petter's wanted to borrow from a bank to invest more, and one of these clients openly claimed getting in excess of 25% a month return on their investment. Petter's associates also had histories that raised questions. One of Petter's business partners was Frank Vaness, who had pleaded guilty earlier in his life to money laundering and no contest to cocaine dealing and illegally selling firearms. He was also a Klobuchar campaign donor. In January 2005, when Petter's company bought Polaroid Holding Company, an amalgam of the assets of the bankrupt camera and film company, accusations swirled that he was making the purchase with stolen cash. Richard Hettler, Petter's convicted former investor who had his records seized by Klobuchar's office back in 1999, made the charge. The records seized documented Hettler's dealings with Petter's. Hettler emailed information to Polaroid CEO, federal and state regulators, and law enforcement officials about his allegations. It was not until late September 2008 that FBI agents raided both Petter's house in Wayzata, just outside Minneapolis, and his office. Days later, the FBI recorded a conversation between Petter's and Robert White, a senior executive with his company. Petter's explained to White his fears about going to jail, but then noted, "We've helped a lot of people with political contributions." Klobuchar, he said, now a U.S. senator, had actually called him days after the raid. He reports that Norm Coleman, Minnesota's other U.S. senator, did not call him. Reportedly, Klobuchar's aide suggested a close family friend, Doug Kelly, a Minneapolis attorney, provide legal help. Kelly had been a longtime friend of Klobuchar's father, both as a lawyer to help him with legal issues and as a mountain climbing partner. Lawyers who were handling the prosecution of Petter's expressed shock at how he had been able to operate so long. Joe Dixon, one of the prosecuting attorneys, explained, "It was like everyone knew PCI, Petter's umbrella company, was a fraud machine, and everyone knew here was a closet up on the third floor that only a few people could look into, and nobody wanted to open the door." Richard Hettler, one of those investors arrested back in 1999 and charged by Klobuchar, claimed that she knew Petter's was involved but elected to look the other way. She took Ponzi money to get elected, he said. Others drew attention to the fact that Petter's was a huge donor to Klobuchar and seemed to get favorable treatment while she was county attorney. "I mean, I know a prosecutor has discretion, and I don't have anything against her. I didn't know her, and I don't have any dog in the fight as far as that goes," attorney Garrett Vail told the Daily Caller. "But it looks to me like he, Petter's, had friends in high places." What I'm getting at is somebody was covering for him. The only way he ran a $3 billion Ponzi scheme was that he had politicians in his pocket. Investigator Randy Shane, Executive Vice President of First Advantage Litigation Consulting, was hired by four independent hedge funds to investigate Petters in the early to mid-2000s. I've been doing this work since 1987, and I've never seen anyone who gave off more warning signals, he said. It is important to note that Klobuchar's law firm, Dorsey & Whitney, did considerable legal work for Petters at this time, including the Polaroid acquisition, and was obviously familiar with the issue. Petters was found guilty on 20 counts of money laundering and wire and mail fraud in December 2009 in U.S. District Court in St. Paul, Minnesota. In the end, the scam involved some $3.7 billion. He was sentenced to 50 years in prison. Politicians from both political parties who had gladly accepted Petters' checks when they were in office now felt obligated to donate those contributions to charity or send them to the Petters estate so that victims of his fraud could get some compensation. Since Amy Klobuchar had taken more money from Petters than anyone, she was obliged to return the most. Klobuchar's considerable political skills include her remarkable ability to raise money from large corporations and corporate lawyers. Early in 2006, Klobuchar recounts how the chairman of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, Senator Chuck Schumer, got in her face with his index finger and told her, "You're going to raise $1 million in the first quarter." Klobuchar did not need advice on raising money. Indeed, she has become one of the Senate's most prolific fundraisers and has done so in an unusual manner. While serving in the U.S. Senate, Klobuchar has a remarkably liberal voting record. To date, in the 116th Congress, she has voted with Bernie Sanders 88% of the time. However, unlike Bernie Sanders, she has also mined corporate donations in a manner that her Vermont colleague has avoided. During her first term, Klobuchar was generally low profile and played it safe. Supporters touted her as a pragmatist working the middle of the road. Minnesota critics saw her as calculating, ambitious, and gauzy on issues. Walter Mondale, her mentor, regards her as a moderate progressive who fits perfectly the tone of Minnesota. Klobuchar defines herself as a progressive. Part of her strategy was using her legislative agenda as a means of extracting donations from powerful corporations who wanted work done on Capitol Hill. One of those techniques included the effective use of earmarks for her campaign funders. During the 2006 Senate run, Klobuchar pounded her opponent because of his voting for earmarks and described the taxpayer-funded dollars as wasted on the bridges to nowhere, the rainforests in Iowa, the waterless urinals in Michigan. Klobuchar pledged during the campaign to cut earmarks because she claimed they were wasteful and reeked of cronyism. But once she was in office, Klobuchar quickly went about using them to great effect for the benefit of her largest supporters. According to Open Secrets, she sponsored or co-sponsored 103 earmarks totaling more than $200 million in fiscal year 2008, her first full year in the Senate. That put her near the top third in the U.S. Senate for earmarks. She had another 88 earmarks totaling more than $133 million in fiscal year 2009. In the last year that members of Congress could officially use earmarks, she had 88 earmarks in excess of $117 million, fiscal year 2010. The earmarks were generous to her largest and most important political supporters. A key earmark was $89.1 million for two light rail projects in Minneapolis over the three-year period. The rail project would provide service for commuters running in and out of the downtown, as well as to the new Minnesota Twins ballpark. The major financial beneficiaries of these earmarks were mega donors to Klobuchar. Klobuchar's old law firm and her second-largest campaign contributor of all time, Dorsey & Whitney, was neck deep in the project. The firm drafted the requests for proposal, or RFPs, for more than $1 billion of public procurement contracts for these light rail projects. Another major beneficiary of the project was the family that owned Major League Baseball's Minnesota Twins. The North Star commuter rail runs right to Target Field, where the Twins play. The Pohlad family owns the team. Carl Pohlad, the patriarch, passed away in 2009. But he was a big supporter of the North Star project because it would help bring more fans to the ballpark. He was a controversial figure in Minneapolis because he got Hennepin County taxpayers to pay for his new baseball stadium. He died a year before Target Field opened. The Pollad family was a large financial supporter of Klobuchar and the DFL party. Between 2006 and 2010, the Pollad family donated tens of thousands to Klobuchar's campaign coffers. The light rail also benefited the Pollad family in other ways, specifically their real estate company, United Properties. The North Star commuter rail line, which stopped near Gate 6 at the stadium, helped boost real estate development in the area. United Properties owns the Ford Center, which is located across the railroad tracks from the stadium. The ties were so deep that Chris Pollad, the grandson of Carl, served as a special assistant to Senator Klobuchar in Washington between 2009 and 2010 while she was issuing the earmarks. Klobuchar's legislative work for the benefit of large donors extends far beyond simple earmarks. From her perch on the powerful Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation, she sits at the crossroads of corporate interests in Washington that wanted something from the federal government. We will see how she became adept at crafting specific legislation that would benefit powerful companies who write her checks, either just before she introduces the legislation or shortly after. In May 2011, Klobuchar stepped forward and introduced a bold bill called the Commercial Felony Streaming Act, S-978. The bill was designed to stop piracy on the Internet, specifically the streaming of songs and music online. According to critics, Klobuchar's was a draconian solution. Namely, individuals who illegally streamed TV shows or movies would be committing a felony. Entertainment industry executives loved the bill for obvious reasons, but it brought her criticism from online freedom advocates. Even those in the music business, like Justin Bieber, thought it went too far. He suggested that she should be locked up for proposing the bill. In the 90 days before she introduced the bill, something unusual started happening. Over a one-week period in February, seven executives from 20th Century Fox sent her donations. Three more wrote her checks in March. Other big entertainment companies opened up their wallets, too. Warner Brothers, via its PAC, gave her a $20,000 contribution, and no fewer than 15 other executives with the company sent her thousands in donations. The Motion Picture Association of America, the Film Industry Association, gave $2,500 in late February. Comcast, the cable giant based out of Philadelphia, which also strongly backed the bill, began giving and would become one of her largest campaign contributors for re-election in 2012, donating more than $26,000. In all, the entertainment industry sent her more than $80,000, a flow of cash she had not experienced before. All of it was collected in the brief period before she introduced the bill. In short, the entertainment industry lined up to salute her bill. And that salute meant cash. She was only getting started. The entertainment industry was not the only one who would give her large, concentrated donations in a short period, only to have her later introduce a bill that they liked. At the end of September 2011, over a six-day period, no fewer than 21 executives from Xcel Energy wrote campaign checks to Klobuchar. Weeks earlier, Klobuchar introduced legislation to amend the IRS Code of 1986 to give a renewable electricity integration tax credit to utility companies. The legislation would give utilities like Xcel Energy federal tax credits for producing renewable energy. Klobuchar was a sponsor of the bill. Xcel Energy lobbied for the bill. She continued to go back to Xcel for more and introduced legislation that they favored. Beginning at the end of May 2017, over a 10-day period, 28 executives from Xcel Energy sent her contributions totaling $12,500. Just 2.5 weeks earlier, she had co-sponsored legislation called the Clean Energy for America Act, which would dramatically expand the tax credits available for companies like Xcel Energy. Despite a voting record remarkably similar to Bernie Sanders, she enjoyed the sort of corporate cash flow about which the senator from Vermont could only dream. Klobuchar likewise aggressively fought for the interests of medical device manufacturers. She pushed a bill that would loosen the conflict of interest rules for advisors to the Food and Drug Administration for approving new medical devices. Klobuchar draws an artificial distinction between medical device manufacturers and pharmaceutical companies when it comes to regulations. She bristles at the power of Big Pharma. The big pharma companies think they own Washington, she has said. Well, they don't own me. But medical device manufacturers enjoy her unending support. On March 17, 2016, Klobuchar introduced the Improving Medical Device Innovation Act, which would relax regulations for the medical device industry. Less than 2 weeks later, 13 executives with medical device manufacturer Medtronic wrote her checks over a three-day period. Back in 2011, Senator Klobuchar invited the CEO of Medtronic as her honored guest to President Obama's State of the Union address. She paid his company and industry homage in announcing the invitation. Klobuchar supports the industry in part because it creates jobs in Minnesota. More to the point, they are large donors to her political campaigns and often cut checks close to when she writes legislation. Klobuchar is unique among progressives in her ability to raise enormous sums from giant corporations. For her re-election in 2018, she raised 38 times the amount of her GOP challenger. She took in donations from the CEOs of 11 of Minnesota's 25 largest corporations. She has done particularly well with law firms and lobbyists. They have donated more than $3 million to her three Senate races. Indeed, no industry has given her more. Lobbyists have been some of her most prolific fundraisers. Lobbying shops such as McGuire Woods, Lock Lord Strategies, Holland & Knight, Flack Associates, Cummington & Burling have held fundraisers in Washington for her. Klobuchar has tried to downplay the flow of corporate cash into her campaign coffers. Her announcement in February 2019 that her presidential campaign would not accept donations from corporate PACs was ironic, given that only months earlier she collected $1.9 million from corporate PACs for her 2018 Senate re-election campaign. This has led Klobuchar to apply her views on regulation and antitrust matters selectively. Klobuchar is the ranking member on the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Antitrust, Competition Policy, and Consumer Rights. The subcommittee is ground zero for large corporations seeking merger approval from the federal government. That power, of course, creates enormous opportunities to raise money from corporations who are donating out of either fear or favor. Klobuchar has always taken the position that she has no clear-cut position on mergers. As she announced in early 2008 during an interview about a potential airline merger, she proclaimed that she had no blanket stance against mergers. This case-by-case approach, which makes sense, also maximizes the opportunity to collect large sums of cash from companies seeking federal approval. Companies that are seeking approval for large mergers and acquisitions are some of her most generous donors. Many of them have found themselves in the target of both the Justice Department's Antitrust Division or the Federal Trade Commission. Medtronic, for example, sought a vertical integration merger to buy a competing firm called MiniMed in 2011. The merger was highly criticized, but not by Klobuchar. Medtronic was her third largest contributor from 2011 to 2016, which coincides with her first re-election bid in 2012. Cargill Incorporated is a giant Minnesota-based food producer and distributor. Valued at approximately $60 billion, it has been one of Klobuchar's top donors. In 2013, it was the subject of a bipartisan probe by President Obama's Justice Department and some Republican attorneys general over its plans to merge with Conagra Foods Incorporated. In the name of protecting consumers, the Obama Justice Department required Cargill to divest from four flour mills in order to approve the deal. Going back four decades, Cargill has faced major anti-competition investigations seven times. All said, Klobuchar does not appear to have questioned many of her corporate donors' acquisitions. Klobuchar was also supportive of carve-outs for Cargill when it came to derivatives regulation. These complex investment vehicles on Wall Street have been highly controversial. Klobuchar supported legislation to rein in the trading of derivatives, but allowed for exemptions that would permit Cargill to continue to leverage them. When she organized an innovation summit with her national innovation agenda, two of the corporate speakers were the corporate VP of Cargill and the chairman CEO of Medtronic, whose companies were major donors. 9. Eric Garcetti. Mayor Eric Garcetti, longtime political fixture in Los Angeles, can run a star-studded campaign like few others. When he was running for mayor in 2013, he tapped his friend and supporter, actress Salma Hayek, to do a video about his merits as a leader. She talked about his skills as a dancer, the fact that he was a military officer, his culinary skills, his gardening acumen, and, finally, the job he was doing as president of the city council. Then there was a fundraiser at the Henry Fonda Theater featuring actor Will Ferrell, talk show host Jimmy Kimmel, and musician Moby. The campaign produced a list of 200 entertainment leaders for Garcetti, which included Michael Eisner, Jake Gyllenhaal, Kevin Spacey, and Michael Ovitz. His campaign finance chair was Sony executive Eric Paquette. Being mayor of the entertainment capital of the world means a melding of politics and celebrity like no place else. Mayor Garcetti, in addition to his apparent dancing skills, has also appeared on several television shows. He has appeared on The Closer and Angie Tribeca, and he is friends with rapper Jay-Z. When the city was planning to shut down the 6th Street Bridge for repairs, the mayor cut an R&B single called 101 Slow Jam as a public service announcement. Eric Garcetti is one of the rising stars in national progressive circles. Journalists regularly point to his solid progressive achievements as mayor and as one of the potential pioneers of progressive policy among America's big city mayors. In 2016, he was reportedly on the list of Hillary Clinton's vice presidential choices. He remains a major player in the Democratic Party. For Garcetti, it is all about a modern progressivism, with a pragmatic twist. In contrast with Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, his public persona and rhetoric appear to be far less hostile to corporations. He wants to make the machinery of government more efficient, bringing it into the smartphone era. Garcetti clearly sees his policies as setting a national agenda, which can be replicated around the country. "We've done it in L.A.," he told the Democratic National Convention in July 2016. "Now let's do it for our entire country." But behind the tinsel and celebrity, Los Angeles has a corrupt political culture, as evidenced by two FBI raids on City Hall, one in November 2018, the other in July 2019. At the heart of L.A. politics is a hardened political operation fueled by an elaborate pay-to-play system where businesses and developers pay money to get their projects approved by the city. It appears to operate like a classic political machine, albeit less explicit than the old Tammany Hall system made famous in the 19th century. The way Garcetti's machine operates often looks like Tammany Hall in Ray-Bans, sleek, stylish, and sophisticated, but at its root, a machine that leverages power for money. Garcetti is an amalgam of Los Angeles. He describes himself as a kosher burrito because of his mixed Jewish and Mexican roots. He grew up in a prominent Los Angeles family. His father, Gil Garcetti, who grew up poor in South L.A., was the famed district attorney whose office took on O.J. Simpson and lost. Eric's mother, Suki, is the daughter of a financially successful clothier. Garcetti's parents were an atheist and an agnostic, but he has embraced his mother's Jewish heritage, studying the Talmud and attending L.A.'s social justice-minded Ikar Synagogue. Eric received an elite education, attending first the Harvard School, the elite prep school in Studio City, California. He then went off to Columbia University. As an undergraduate at Columbia University, Garcetti organized a protest against a nearby market that had forbidden the homeless from redeeming cans and bottles for the 5 and 10 cent deposits. "We hope to resolve this without it getting messy," he declared. "But the managers seem to be assholes who have to be hit hard." From Columbia, he went to Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship. It was on his way to the city of Spires that he met his future wife, Amy Wakeland. Raised in Indiana, Wakeland was a Rhodes Scholar too. They formed a solid team and core from the beginning, and today she is widely considered one of his closest advisors. After they returned from England and had settled in Los Angeles, Eric ran for city council. Wakeland served as the campaign field director and was described as a general charging into battle. In contrast to her husband's more laid-back style, Wakeland is tough. She is fierce, a deputy mayor under Antonio Villaraigosa, Garcetti's predecessor, who has worked with Wakeland, told Los Angeles Magazine. She has remained a central component of his power structure, recruiting many of the top aides who serve with him in the mayor's office. She also reportedly has oversight of his schedule. Garcetti has been a long-time political fixture in Los Angeles. He was first elected to the Los Angeles City Council back in 2001, and then for 6 years served as the City Council president, which essentially gave him complete control of the legislative agenda for the city. During his earliest days as a member of the City Council, Garcetti aligned himself with the interests of Los Angeles's developers. Los Angeles has very strict zoning and environmental laws when it comes to construction projects, but the laws allow the City Council and the mayor to make exceptions. And under Garcetti, they have done so an overwhelming majority of the time. If a builder can get these politicians to give them an exception, it can result in an enormous windfall. As we will see, the way builders get those exceptions is by showering politicians and their families with cash. Garcetti also became a supporter of using eminent domain to push people out of their property so that newer, larger projects could be built. He once offered, "The city would not use its powers of eminent domain to force property owners to sell, unless the developers were unable to reach a deal with the landowners. Reasons Matt Welsh argues, in short, that the city is going to take your property. You had better take the deal." Even as the president of the Los Angeles City Council, Garcetti was a rising star in national politics. President Barack Obama tried to lure him to the White House, according to Garcetti, to serve as his urban czar. They met in the Oval Office to discuss having him join the Obama administration. "He said I could oversee HUD, or Department of Housing and Urban Development, and HHS, or Health and Human Services, and Education and Transportation. It would have been an amazing opportunity." But Garcetti had larger ambitions, including running for mayor. And perhaps further down the road, he hoped to be sitting on the other side of the desk in the Oval Office. From president of the Los Angeles City Council, Garcetti ran for mayor. He won both elections handily, but he benefited from voter apathy and low turnout. The 2013 election was a very low turnout election. Indeed, so few people in Los Angeles voted, Garcetti was elected with just 222,300 votes, equivalent to what was needed in the 1930s when LA was half the size. He was reelected in 2017 in an election where just 1 in 5 eligible voters turned out. The move to the mayor's office brought him more broad-ranging powers that could affect the fortunes of developers and other businesses. In Los Angeles, the mayor and other elected officials have enormous power to make developers rich with changes to the zoning code, waivers to planning requirements, and other benefits for real estate projects. Tweaking the law can dramatically increase the market value of commercial parcels of land and buildings by expanding their possible use or allowing larger buildings to be constructed than regulations allow. They can also exempt future real estate projects from the California Environmental Quality Act. These favors can, over a number of projects, translate into billions of dollars for builders and developers. In August 2013, Rick Jacobs joined Garcetti's office as Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations. During the 2013 mayoral run, Jacobs was a major fundraiser for the campaign. He was the founder of a consultancy firm called RDJ Strategic Advisors, which provides expertise to ultra-high net worth families, investors, nonprofits, and corporations. Earlier in his career, Jacobs was assistant to the chairman of Occidental Petroleum, which was headed by the controversial Armand Hammer. Jacobs says that he took 60 trips to the Soviet Union in the 1980s. Hammer, it was later revealed, worked as a virtual spy for the Soviet Union and was a conduit for money that financed communist espionage operations. With his elevation to the mayor's office, Garcetti set up the infrastructure for a self-funding political influence machine. Each of the roles that Rick Jacobs played appeared to be a gateway between those looking for favors from the city government and the mayor's own political and personal ambitions. The merging of Garcetti's political machine with the official powers of the LA mayor became further apparent when Jacobs, who was officially the deputy chief of staff, began to introduce himself as executive vice mayor of Los Angeles. It was a non-existent position in Los Angeles city government. The title was apparently inspired by a role common in China. In June 2014, Garcetti launched a nonprofit he called the Mayor's Fund for Los Angeles. The nonprofit was explicitly linked to the city's government and worked on Garcetti's projects. Jacobs claims to have created the organization and would go on to serve as the treasurer and director. Jacobs would remain attached to the Mayor's Fund, but on July 20, 2016, Jacobs left the mayor's office on a leave of absence to focus on outside political and civic activities, including Garcetti's reelection campaign and another Garcetti pet project, Measure M, an initiative for a sales tax increase to fund infrastructure projects. The initiative was a merging of interests. Jacobs' company was paid almost $90,000 to advise on the initiative. The largest single donation to the Yes on M campaign was a political action committee, or PAC, for the infrastructure firm HNTB, which stood to gain a lot from its passage. In November 2016, Measure M passed. It was expected to raise $120 billion over a 40-year period for infrastructure projects. In late October 2017, Garcetti launched a nonprofit called Accelerator for America, alongside South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, with Jacobs as CEO. In November 2017, Garcetti launched the Democratic Midterm Victory Fund, a PAC to support Democrats in the 2018 midterms. Jacobs' firm, RDJ Strategic Advisors, was paid $231,797 by the PAC during the 2018 cycle, nearly 10% of what it raised. Jacobs was accused of using extortion tactics against opponents of some of the mayor's initiatives. Opponents of Measure EE, a tax plan backed by Garcetti, were reportedly warned of voicing opposition. The LA Times reported, Tracy Hernandez, founding chief executive of the Los Angeles County Business Federation, known as BizFed, said Measure EE campaign manager Rick Jacobs told her during a phone call last month that BizFed members who campaign against the measure won't do any business in the city of LA for the next 4 years. Jacobs denied the allegations. One mechanism for receiving money is a California loophole known as behested payments. This allows politicians to establish nonprofits and then solicit money for those nonprofits from businesses who want something from their office. Few in California politics have been more effective at doing this than Eric Garcetti. The contributions are often large, much larger than campaign contributions, and they are mostly unregulated. Observers note the irony that Garcetti excels at collecting large sums, given that he is a longtime critic of big money in local politics. Between 2009 and 2017, Garcetti took in $31.9 million in such payments from individuals, businesses, and foundations, some of which have won sizable contracts and crucial approvals from the city in recent years. The bulk of those behested payments were directed to the mayor's fund, which fused together city government and his own political machine. To get a sense of the scale of Garcetti's money stream, that was twice what California Governor Jerry Brown raised in behested payments during the same period, and more than 40 times what the then Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom did. Behested payments provide an ideal opportunity for the very wealthy and the lobbyists to buy access to lawmakers, said Craig Holman with the group Public Citizen. Garcetti's use of behested payments is ironic given that back in 2011 he pushed for an initiative that was supposed to reduce the flow of big money. Charter Amendment H barred campaign contributions from those bidding on city contracts larger than $100,000. Special interests are always trying to buy influence at City Hall, he said at the time. Charter Amendment H will help stop them. But what was not included in that ban was behested payments. And while campaign contributions were capped at $1,400 for the Los Angeles mayor's race, behested payments have no restrictions. Politicians are required to disclose behested payments only if they are more than $5,000 a year per donor. Consider the case of AT&T. The telecom giant was a $30 million contractor with the city of Los Angeles, so it could not make campaign contributions. But Garcetti's fund collected three payments totaling $105,000 from the company over a six-month period. Likewise, in 2015, Verizon received a contract worth up to $15 million from the city. Again, they were not allowed to make a campaign contribution. But a little more than a month after they received approval for that contract, they donated $100,000 to Garcetti's fund. If there's anyone that's paying attention, you realize that the company doesn't have to give the money to the legislator directly, notes broadband industry analyst Craig Settles. You just basically funnel it into different activities where the elected official can get a great photo op and then, boom, there you go. Less well-known companies got into the game, too. An LA landscaping company called Turf Terminators got behind Garcetti. They cashed in more than $23 million in rebates. In April, 13 contributions were made to Garcetti's campaign and his nonprofit, totaling $25,650. Just a month later, Garcetti mentioned the company in his 2015 State of the City address. He even pointed out the company's 29-year-old former CEO in the audience. The company, which converts lawns to less water-intensive landscaping, is a niche but lucrative business. Homeowners and the company receive rebates from the local utility or the water district. After Garcetti mentioned them in the State of the City address, they saw a business boom. As the local CBS affiliate put it, turf terminators would go on to take in millions of dollars in ratepayer rebates. Limits on the amount that a donor can give directly to a candidate are in place for a reason, and that's to limit corruption, says Brendan Fisher, an attorney with the Campaign Legal Center in Washington, D.C. By a donor being allowed to support a public official above and beyond the legal contribution limit undermines the law's anti-corruption purpose. The reason is that the behested gifts are actually solicited by the politician. As Columbia Law professor Richard Brefault notes, a true gift may come out of the blue, unasked for, and may not even be something the covered person wants. But a behested gift is one that the public servant has actually asked for, so the likelihood of actual gratitude is much higher. The mayor's fund often appears to sit on cash rather than passing it out to charities. The nonprofit only spent about 40% of the money donated during the first two full years. People who have business pending in the city of Los Angeles shouldn't be making payments at the behest of the mayor, says Bob Stern, a former general counsel of the California Fair Political Practices Commission. At one point during his 2013 mayoral campaign, Garcetti made a public declaration that he would not accept campaign contributions from Walmart on the grounds that they paid their workers low wages. But the following year, he collected a $100,000 check from Walmart for the mayor's fund, at his behest. The flow of money from those who got approval for projects was staggering. Developer Samuel Lung was seeking to clear a real estate project near the port of Los Angeles. He wanted to construct a residential development in an industrial area of the city known as Harbor City. Lung was accused of then using straw donors to funnel hundreds of thousands of dollars to local politicians, including Garcetti. On the same day in February 2015, there were multiple checks written in what appeared to be the same handwriting from Lung's handyman, a gardener, and a chef for a hotel run by his company. Later, when asked about the contributions, these individuals either denied ever making them or said that they did not remember giving. Lung wanted to build apartments in an area zoned industrial. Residential properties, of course, offer much larger profit margins than industrial real estate. The city's planning commission had rejected the proposal in March 2014. Janice Hahn, who was a U.S. representative at the time, received more than $200,000 in straw or real donations from those connected to Lung. Indeed, in 2013, Lung coughed up $60,000 for a committee seeking to elect Garcetti as mayor. The organization, dubbed Committee for a Safer Los Angeles, was an independent expenditure committee run for his benefit. Garcetti employed a rarely used mayoral prerogative that reduced the number of city council members needed to approve the project. That did the trick. The project was approved. Hahn later became a Los Angeles County supervisor. In December 2016, not long after the news broke of the payments from Lung, Hahn hired the mayor's sister, Dana Garcetti-Bolt, as a policy advisor. After Garcetti's sister joined her staff, legal problems continued to follow Hahn. An aide for Hahn was convicted on bribery charges in an unrelated case in March 2018. As we will see, Dana Garcetti-Bolt's husband would also become enmeshed in controversial projects at the center of an FBI probe. Lung has been indicted on bribery and money laundering charges related to this case. He has denied the charges. The FBI launched investigations related to other real estate development projects approved in Los Angeles. These involved several Chinese-controlled companies. In 2018, the FBI issued a search warrant as part of a federal corruption probe into potential crimes involving Los Angeles City Council member Jose Huizar. The probe focused on high-rise development projects in downtown Los Angeles, funded by Chinese investment companies. The warrant specifically named the Shenzhen New World Group, a Chinese real estate firm. Shenzhen is looking to build the tallest building in Los Angeles on the site of the Grand Hotel. The warrant also named Greenland USA, another Chinese firm, and sought email communications from Raymond Chan, an LA city official who served as Garcetti's deputy mayor for economic development. The FBI executed a warrant asking Google for all communications and data connected to Chan's Gmail account. The mayor named him interim head of the LA Department of Building and Safety in 2013 and the permanent director the following year. He was then appointed Garcetti's deputy mayor, lasting a year at that post. The warrant noted that it was seeking information on other foreign investors not yet identified. The FBI also raided council member Jose Huizar's house and office to look for evidence of money laundering, bribery, conspiracy, extortion, and kickbacks, among other possible crimes. Huizar, his family, and his staffers were included in the search warrant. Another council member, Curran Price, was also named in the FBI investigation. Joel Jacinto, a Garcetti appointee who sat on the Board of Public Works, also resigned because of the investigation. No charges had been filed against any of the politicians being investigated as of the date this book was sent to press. As the New York Times put it, the warrant described a sprawling web of possible corruption. Local observers saw the scandal as reminiscent of the 1974 movie Chinatown about shady real estate deals. A citizens group called Coalition to Preserve L.A. sent a 54-page complaint to the L.A. County Civil Grand Jury requesting an investigation into corruption involving Garcetti and developers. The group complained that Garcetti had closed-door meetings with developers who were putting money into the mayor's fund. City Councilman David Ryu tried to ban some contributions from developers, but his reforms were thwarted by the City Council's decision to delay the vote. The Shenzhen New World Group purchased the Los Angeles Marriott downtown and the Sheraton Universal Hotel for an estimated $150 million in 2010 and 2011, respectively. Oceanwide Holdings, another Chinese firm, was developing Oceanwide Plaza, a housing and retail project near the Staples Center, where the Los Angeles Lakers play. The billion-dollar three-tower complex high-rise would feature 504 condominiums, retail space, and a five-star hotel. Zinner Consultants, an environmental firm that just happens to employ Garcetti's brother-in-law, Glenn Bolt, as an executive, listed the Park Hyatt, which is part of Oceanwide Plaza, as a project on which they consult. The aforementioned Greenland USA was approved for the Metropolis development. The four-tower complex was another $1 billion project. Again, Garcetti's brother-in-law's firm was retained as a consultant on the project. Projects linked to Garcetti's brother-in-law seemed to do well in City Hall. When the developers sought to redevelop the Century Plaza Hotel, Garcetti not only approved of the project, he also helped arrange international funding for the redevelopment. Zinner Consultants was again hired as mitigation consultants for the project. Garcetti's ties to developers went even deeper. The Zola family is a major developer of real estate in Los Angeles. Garcetti co-owns with the Zola family a small boutique hotel called the Inn at Playa del Rey. The Zolas also owned several properties on Manchester Avenue, located near the site of a redevelopment project along Los Angeles International Airport's northern rim, something called the LAX Northside Plan Update. The Inn at Playa del Rey is also not far from the project site. Garcetti has championed the project. Developer Rick Caruso donated $125,000 to Garcetti's nonprofit. Caruso wanted to develop a project that was too tall, given zoning restrictions. A year later, his development project, with only slight modifications, got the necessary approvals to proceed. Garcetti's apparent willingness to look the other way when it comes to city corruption involving his political allies includes the Los Angeles Fire Department, or LAFD. In late 2015, LAFD officials found that Inspector Glenn Martinez had claimed hundreds of hours of overtime for his inspection work. Internal investigators at the LAFD looked into his claims and discovered that no one had actually seen him where he had professed to work. For example, he claimed to have put in 6.5 hours of inspection time at Our Lady Help of Christians School, but he was not seen by anyone on site. In another case, he claimed to have spent 4 hours inspecting two buildings at Occidental College. The problem? The campus at the time was shut down for winter break. And again, nobody saw him on the premises. Now, this might seem like just another case of government employees milking the system, but there is more to the story. Deputy Fire Chief John Vidovich investigated this and other cases of overbilling and brought the matter to the attention of his boss, LAFD Chief Ralph Terrazas. Terrazas, Mayor Garcetti, and the mayor's chief of staff, Ana Guerrero, sat on the reports for nearly a year. Then Garcetti reassigned Vidovich. That reassignment coincided with the donation of $350,000 to his reelection campaign and those of his city council successors by the Firefighters Union. Vidovich sued the city in January 2017, alleging that Mayor Garcetti and his aides, with the help of the fire chief, pushed him out of his office at the bidding of the Firefighters Union. In his case, he claimed that he was pushed out because he exposed illegal and fraudulent acts by inspectors, particularly some who were padding their pockets by making implausible overtime claims. According to court documents, Fire Chief Terrazas told Vidovich that the mayor's office has me over a barrel and had to push him out. When asked who in the mayor's office pushed him, Terrazas reportedly said, "The mayor." Garcetti and aides denied the allegation, but the city ended up settling with Vidovich and reportedly paid him $800,000 to make the case go away. Eric Garcetti has been at the center of Los Angeles political power since 2001. When Garcetti goes to his office at City Hall, on the south side of the building there is a quote from Cicero. "He that violates his oath profanes the divinity of faith itself." On the north side there is an etched quote from the 19th century poet James Russell Lowell. "The highest of all sciences and services, the government." While during his tenure he has constructed an efficient political machine for extracting money from companies who are doing business with the city of Angels continues to struggle. It does poorly in quality of life rankings. Richard Florida, the urban theorist, places the Los Angeles area dead last among the 20 largest metro areas in the country when it comes to rankings of inequality and poverty. According to a study conducted by the University of California, Los Angeles, or UCLA, 25% of people in Los Angeles spend half of their income on rent, the highest of any major metropolitan area. And Los Angeles continues to be plagued with a massive and inefficient government. Because of red tape, as of 2016, it took an average of 373 days to hire someone. Also, nearly one out of every six employees on the city payroll is off the job on workers' compensation, and it is twice as bad for the police and fire departments. Another senior city official puts it more bluntly. "You have to understand, it's a fucking miracle your trash gets picked up." Conclusion. Corrupt acts can take various forms. As we have seen, these can include using your political power to enrich your family, tilting the scales of justice for the benefit of friends, steering government contracts to friends and family, or using the machinery of your office to serve your interests rather than those of the people you are supposed to represent. The progressive solution for every national problem is to give them and our political leadership more power. So, how have they managed the power they have already been granted? The progressives featured in this book all profess that they have the purest of motives in their quest for greater power. They seek that power for our benefit, or to fix our problems, or so they claim. Even if we take them at their word, the reality is that, as economist and Nobel laureate Milton Friedman reminds us, concentrated power is not rendered harmless by the good intentions of those who create it. History teaches that corruption follows power. The more power you accumulate, the more likely you are to exploit that power for your own benefit. History also teaches that power tempts those who wield it into corrupt acts. Founding Father George Washington once worried, "Few men have virtue to withstand the highest bidder." But the problem is not just with accumulated power, but also with those who seek it. As scientist and author David Brin pointedly noted, "It is said that power corrupts, but actually it's more true that power attracts the corruptible." Whichever is more true, the link between power and corruption is an iron rule of human history. What political figures do with the power they enjoy reveals a lot about who they are. The great historian Robert Caro has written a masterful four-volume set of books on the public life of President Lyndon Baines Johnson. After he finished the fourth volume, he commented on the truths he uncovered in his decades-long study of public power. "What I believe is always true about power is that power always reveals." This book has hopefully served as a revelation of how power is exercised and how it can be twisted to serve the ends of those who seek more of it. It is, of course, very easy to blame our public figures for the state of public corruption. But ultimately, the problem lies with us. We get the government that we choose and the leaders we elect. Novelist and essayist George Orwell wrote the masterpiece 1984 about a dystopian future, but he was also a shrewd observer of political life in democracies. He warned about the political choices people make regularly in an elective system of government. "A people that elect corrupt politicians, imposters, thieves, and traitors are not victims, but accomplices." The progressive message continues to be, "Hand us more power." What they are asking us to do is ignore history, including their history, in how such power is actually exercised. We must ask ourselves, why trust someone with more power when you cannot even trust them with the little they already have? This is Charles Constant. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Profiles in Corruption, Abuse of Power by America's Progressive Elite, by Peter Schweitzer, presented by HarperCollins and Harper Audio. This program was produced by B Audio Limited, executive producer Suzanne Franco Mitchell, text copyright 2019 by Peter Schweitzer, production copyright 2020 by HarperCollins Publishers, all rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.